back to Big Mouth, where the spirit of the smash hits Biscuit Tin lives on. I'm Andrew Harrison, and to help me sort through the brand tub of movies, film and television, as usual, I have Sean Pattenden, the capable Mildred Roper to my inept George. Hello, Sean, how are you?
I'm all right.
Colleague, how's your week been?
It's been very good, very busy, and it is going to continue to be.
Yeah, okay. Sounds good. What have we got? What have we got this week?
On this week's show, we'll be discussing Kunk on Britain, Who Needs Civilizations with Mary Beard and Her Mates, when you have Screenwipe's premier investigative reporter to explain who we are and why we are here. We'll also be looking at Going for a Song, a new book covering the history of the record shop. And we'll be spanking our nethers, yes we will, with a metaphorical tambourine for the new 25th birthday edition of Suede's debut album. And continuing a vague theme of shame and poor taste, we will be asking our guests to name the objectively bad song they nonetheless love. And they really do love these songs.
They do, in which case we'd better meet those guests. And it is a Face magazine heavy week this week. Making his Big Mouth debut is Craig McLean, feature writer for The Telegraph, former staffer at The Face and unabashed Scottish person. Hello, Craig. How are you doing?
I am very well, Andrew. Thank you very much.
If only we were doing this on Periscope or Facebook Live or something, everybody could see your lovely T-shirt, which says The Smith, the singular. What is it?
The Smith is, I'm sad to say, an upmarket brunch joint in New York where they very cannily decided to nick the Smith's font and do merch for their staff and any eager punter who comes along. I think I might have been the first person who ever bought one from them. But I might be looking for a job there as well, so it might come in handy.
But you stick with the journalism, you're quite good at it, you know. is this a meat-friendly place?
They do serve meat, but I had none, I can reassure you.
Okay, I wanted reassuring in the other direction, actually. I'm hoping they're doing a Morrissey burger or something large with plenty of bacon in it. Also here is Craig's old boss, Richard Benson, former editor of The Face, and now an award-winning author of non-fiction books, including The Farm, which is about an actual farm and not the groovy train hit makers. Hello, Richard.
Hello, hi.
Welcome back to Big Mouth. How are you doing?
I'm very well. It's very nice to be back. Yes, thank you.
Have you been to any pop-related restaurants lately?
Oh, Lord above. I haven't. I was thinking how it's almost like these days everything ends as a restaurant almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and it's... You know, I think Miranda Sawyer makes that point, doesn't she? About Saturday morning TV became about cooking instead of being about pop music. So maybe maybe the Smiths to the Smith is just part of a big cycle.
Absolutely. Can you see the Key Fernandos, as the old line went? Craig, Richard was your old boss. Was he a good boss?
Richard was a very good boss. I owe Richard many things, not all of which I can talk about on the air.
Yeah.
But he is possibly one of the key reasons I actually live in the London. And forswore my life in damp old Scotland. And he gave me my first ever cover feature at The Face, which was an interview with Björk, in the course of which I managed to break my arm very unprofessionally.
One break one's arm professionally? Perhaps playing fight football or something?
Well, if I'd been trying to save her from an assassin, for example, that would have been professionally. But the unprofessional answer was I was shadowing her for 48 hours as she did a bevy of international press in a 17th century French abbey a few miles outside Paris for her second album, and I sat and watched her be bombarded with inane questions about the sugar cubes and puffins from a cornucopia of international journalists. After 48 hours, she was going even more bonkers than normal, as was I. Much Key Royale was drunk, something I'd never had before. And thereafter, some play fighting erupted in the abandoned graveyard outside involving Björk, Stefan Sedenui, her sometime paramour, I believe.
Oh, yes.
Neil Hannon, who was bizarrely there
by
Hop, had been sent there by Hop Press to interview her, and a couple of other people. Anyway, a couple of play fights and rugby tackles later, I fell arm first into and toppled over gravestone. And the next thing I knew, Björk and her 6-foot Icelandic masseuse pal Yuga were...
Of the song fame.
I think it might have been of the song fame, were ministering to me with chocolate Easter eggs. It was Easter time. And a bizarre car battery contraption, by which means they diagnosed that, yes, my arm was broken and I should go to hospital.
It'll be the anniversary of
that. Yeah.
The 90s, ladies and gentlemen. That was the 90s.
Most people broke their arms in the 90s.
So thank you, Richard, for
that. It's all your fault. Was Craig a good staff member? While we're doing a bit of some HR, independent HR on the podcast.
Can I say that Craig was a very good staff member? And just picking up on the idea of you breaking your arm, I think what really distinguished him was his willingness to risk physical injury for the magazine, not merely the usual stresses that one might face as a journalist. And, of course, he did... at the face it was quite famous, have an encounter where you defended the magazine's honour against Tricky, didn't you?
Oh, God, yeah. Mm. That's correct, yeah.
It was impugning. He's impugning the face.
Tricky took some umbrage with something he thought I had written in the Face magazine, so much so that there was a one-sided fisticuffs altercation backstage in the select tent at Glastonbury in 1998, that rainy World Cup. Glastonbury.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
So, again, the 90s. 20 years ago this summer.
20 years ago this summer. We could do a special commemorative edition on this. Mm. Tricky fist fight edition. Shall we crack on? We're going to get started in a minute after this brief message from Sean.
Baco 4 suited Sheffield crooners ABC wanted to know how to be a zillionaire. But we will settle for covering the expenses on Big Mouth with your kind help. Actually, ABC had turned into Hanna-Barbera cartoons by then, but you know what I mean. We're asking listeners to figuratively buy us a pint once a month via the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Just a fiver a month from 120 listeners will cover all our studio's costs and enable Big Mouth to carry on in rude health. We're aiming to raise £600 a month and we're already a bit over a third of the way there.
Hurrah!
When we reach our target, we can start recording extra bits each week just for our lovely Patreon backers. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. Or if you're still on Facebook, there's the Big Mouth Facebook page thing there, but I wouldn't recommend it. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
Yes, there you go. Share your data and be targeted by alt-rights and Nazi people in order to buy us a pint for the price of £5. It's all worth it in the long run. Okay, let's get started with the cutting edge of social reportage. Philomena Kunk is the Richard Dimbleby of our era, a fearless explorer of the modern condition whose reports from Screen Wipe have done more to show us who we are than any contemporary rival. Now she gets her own five-part tentpole series, Kunk on Britain, starting next week. She'll be exploring our glorious post-Brexit future, our non-glorious pre-Brexit past, and asking key questions such as, what if spaghetti is illegal? And we're going to talk about it after this small taster.
Today, Britain stands at a fork in its crossroads. Now we've got our country back. What actually is it? The best way to find out where we're heading is to look behind us at some of the biggest faces in British history and to ask other people's faces about them.
How did Sir Walter Raleigh invent the potato?
So join me, Philomena Kunk, as I take you right up the history of the United Britain of Great Kingdom. Kunk on Britain!
On BBC Two.
One Nation Under a Groove, getting down just for the kunk of it. Oh. Diane Morgan as the great Philomena Kunk there. Richard Benson, what did you make of Kunk on Britain?
Right, I was a fan of Philomena Kunk from the previous stuff that she's done. And I was a big fan of this for about 7 minutes of it. And I thought that if it had lasted 7 minutes, it would have been great. I felt that it was over 30 minutes. It felt like a sketch dragged out to a...
That was her original format, wasn't it? She'd be there for a little kind of kunk moment in the middle of Screen Wipe.
Yes.
And then which would stand in sharp contrast to the reality around it.
Yeah.
Did you feel you were a bit over-gagged with it?
Yeah, and I thought that the gags seemed to get more repetitive as you went along. So I thought, oh, you know, the idea of asking daft questions to an expert and the expert being a bit fazed by that is kind of funny the first two or three times. I thought by the end of it, I kind of felt like I'd had enough. I think that, for me, the funniest thing about this and the key point for me that she makes is this thing about TV formats overtaking the content. So there's a great thing she said, there's a brilliant line where she did some shows about Shakespeare. And when she's in the trailer for that, she says, "I've been interested in Shakespeare for as long as I've been researching this programme." Which we all know is how TV really works. And in Kunk on Britain, when she's asking the questions and the experts won't give her the answer that she wants, so she just asks them the question again, hoping that they'll give her the right one. That is how a lot of TV works. You get told the answer that you're meant to get from the question, and if you don't
before
get
you've even
trouble.
Done it, so yeah. You've done the interview before you've even met the person, you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that point about TV formats is one that is really worth making, because it devalues television, and I think there's kind of a political edge to it. It's almost now that if you create something that works in that format, you can get on air regardless of what the substance of what you're saying is. So to satirise that, I think, is great, but the level of jokes in it I found not great, and it reminded me a little bit of possibly the unfunniest comedy in the world, which is that stuff on Radio 4 between about 6 and 7 o'clock.
Oh, God, I think we're really harsh there. See, I actually really enjoyed it. I didn't find myself joked out. I like the fact that it's incredibly packed and that every line demonstrates a kind of willful, dedicated, almost heroic stupidity and ignorance. And the fact that she's got all the kind of traits of the proper documentary presenter now, specifically staring into space, looking like she's thinking deep thoughts while orchestral music plays. Craig, what did you make of it?
I cleave more towards your opinion, Andrew. I thought I liked the repetition of the zingers. You know, it's like the Lady Bird books, which two of the co-writers, Jason Hazley and Joel Morris, write. Every page in those books is, if not a zinger, then a Swanee whistle at least. You wouldn't watch it again. You wouldn't read them again. But every single line is funny. Every single word almost, you know, the Stone's Age, Middle Evil, Baywatch tapestry.
The Baywatch tapestry, you know, made me laugh,
you know,
out loud.
From Ancient Man to Ed Sheeran. You know, the emphasis on syllables. I thought just the level of detail was fantastic. And I can't get enough of the likes of Robert Peston, you know, almost blowing up with his inability to answer the question of what the most political thing ever to happen is. I like that endless kind of repetition of it. And, you know, 5 episodes would probably be enough for me. You know, I don't know why it's not 6, which is the norm. Maybe they were listening to what Richard was saying there and they thought 5 would be enough. But no, broadly, I liked it. You know, when she's trying to find out from that historian who explains to her that, you know, the span of human history is 24 hours and we're in the last minute, and she goes, so rocks are more jaggedy?
Yes.
You know, the cluelessness she handles with bolting aplomb.
That bit of the aspect of the interviews with the experts, I think is really funny, but it's also really interesting because I can't imagine that now that Kunk has got a bit of a name, that they are unaware, particularly Peston.
I think he is aware and he was just playing it. But I think he knows the other ones might not.
They look
have
like
known.
Kind of fusty academics who could they have been spent the last 20 years in a library. Yeah. Mm. No bad thing.
Yeah. But what I like about it is there's no sort of chummy idea that people are all in it together. It's not, you know, Keith Lemon hasn't turned up to punch you in the shoulder and get you to play along. You know, it's not like, you know, Mary Berry appearing in the Gunge Tank or anything like that. Everybody genuinely seems bewildered that a human being could be so dense as to be asking, did we get the Black Death because of rats, because of freedom of movement and rats refusing to integrate into British society?
I mean, does that just speak to the power of the BBC? Like when a historian or academic gets an email saying, oh, the BBC want to talk to you about a documentary. Oh, great, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And they don't question who it is or what it is. They just do it. You know, God bless the BBC for, you know, being a Trojan horse for this kind of daft comedy, then.
Yeah, but I mean, Peston's agent must know this. If so, it's a masterful performance, I think.
I wanted to do
But also, going back to that point about what it exposes about television, it kind of exposes the role of the expert in those shows, doesn't it? Because the expert, when they're asked a stupid question and the answer is no, they feel they can't give the answer. They have to go, well, so there's a point when she's asking about King Arthur and Camelot and Tamerlot. And the expert.
The gag here for listeners who haven't heard it is like, so she says, King Arthur came a lot, didn't he? And the expert is just completely befuddled.
I felt really sorry for him.
But the interesting thing about those situations is they're so imprisoned by what television expects of you that you can see behind their eyes is flickering this impulse to just stand up and say, this is ridiculous, what the hell are you talking about? But it's television, and you can't do that. So they're on rails, aren't they? They're imprisoned within the whole thing.
Yeah, so you're showing the power of TV and what it does, and then that does make you see other things that you might watch afterwards differently, which to me, that's, as I said, the point of the show.
Yeah, there's a great bit as well where the recurrent need to relate things in a banal way to the modern day. You know, Henry VIII, who was very much his generation's Kim Kardashian, or Stonehenge, it was like Nemesis at Alton Towers. That's what television has to do, isn't it?
Or talking about the chalk drawings on hills, you know, before Snapchat, hills were the most efficient way to distribute dick pics.
I liked it when it got surreal. So I agree with you, Richard. Sometimes I just thought, why am I watching this thing? Because it's a pastiche, it's fine, but I kind of get it. After 7 minutes, I do get it. There's a bit where she mentions brush Strokes, the 80s sitcom. Yes. And we have this really long, they show the whole of the start of Brushstrokes. The theme song, you have the star of it, I've forgotten his name, walking along no reason whatsoever. Yeah. And I thought that was fantastic. It's about 3 minutes of a Brushstrokes.
And it's in both episodes. Is it going to be in every episode?
I hope it's going to be a running gag. But the best bit about that was like they ran it long enough and then the edit really is long. Deliberately brutal and inept, and she's walking through a park again, studiously doing TV presenter hands. You know that TV presenter hands thing where they sort of put the palm outwards towards you to sort of make you think you're receiving
That's
information.
It's really hard to know what to do with your hands when you're in front of a camera.
Just put it in your pockets. I don't know. Scratch your head. But there's TV presenter hands, which I wish there was podcast presenter hands. We could do a picture of it.
It does hark back to that thing. The first thing that I remember Charlie Brooker ever doing, Richard, when we did it in the face, TV Go Home, his fake Radio Times listings.
Yes.
He completely blew up the nonsense of radio and TV listings formats at the time. That was, I think, the first thing that brought Charlie Brooker to prominence. This at the other end of his career, or not the end of his career, but this bit of his career is a similar thing. He's blowing up, as you said, Rich, the norms.
Well, I did a piece on him a while ago for the Late Great Word magazine, and he talked a bit about how TV Go Home kind of wrecked TV commissioning in a sense, because he'd find himself having these ideas and then thinking, well, that's really TV Go Home. I can't come up with that. But he'd be in the environment of TV commissioners who'd go, yeah, Daily Mail Island, that's a really great idea. Mick Hucknall's Pink Pancakes, could we do it? You know, all this kind of stuff. So the kind of Alan Partridge...
Yeah, Monkey Tennis.
Monkey Tennis, youth hustling with Chris Eubank thing. Television now is as stupid, if not more so, as it was when they imagined it. What do we think of her? I'm a big fan of Diane Morgan. I think her studied blankness and her ability to... maybe this is brilliant editing. She never, ever cracks. No. I love it.
She's great. And apparently, you know, Charlie Brooker wanted the character to be posh in the original conception. And she had to audition with a posh accent, which she practiced hard to get. And then she did one in her own Bolton accent, and that's the one that stuck. And thank God it did, because that's far more... impressive and disarming than a posho.
Yeah, because it sort of plugs into that, it satirises that other aspect, which is, you know, the broadcasting's mania for, you know, push it as far away from RP as possible to have a spread of accents, you know. And so you've got this person who is manifestly dim, but, you know, she kind of fits into the commissioning process. I think she's absolutely fantastic. Would you have put her on the cover of The Face if The Face was still going?
Yeah, might have done.
It's too old, mate. 42.
Oh, but she looks quite young. I would have pitched hard for that. I would have said, Richard, let me do it.
What would you have dressed her as? Björk?
I don't know. That's for these lads.
She's awesome in Motherland, so, you know, as
oh,
well.
Yeah, she's great.
She's
in
the
Motherland.
Star of Motherland, yeah. I think, to Sharon Horgan's most recent sitcom.
It would have been great to get her to go and do, like, backstage fashion shows, wouldn't it?
I'd love to.
Oh, yeah.
Like, talking to the fashion designers.
Yeah, that's the good feature.
Because they really wouldn't understand whether she
that's the feature.
Whether it was satire or not.
Yeah,
that'd
so,
be good.
You know, Kunk does Fashion Week.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you listening, commissioners?
In the imaginary face. Well, of course, The Face has been bought by our friends at formerly Development Hell Mix Mag. So if you're listening, Development Hell Mix Mag, the Brains Trust is here. Anyway, we better crack on.
Yes, let's have some music. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune for the listeners. Richard Benson, what have you got for us today?
I have got a track called It Ain't Me, Babe by Betty LeVette. And it's a cover of a famous old Bob Dylan song. And what's really nice about it, I think, is two things. I mean, one is that it makes you, like a great cover, it makes you listen to the original differently. And I think it really makes you aware of the that kind of really horrible egotism and slight misogyny that Bob Dylan had at that period. Uh-huh. You hear the sort of nastiness in that song that you maybe didn't hear before. Because she kind of turns it into this song about being a bit... It's partly because it's from a woman's point of view, and her voice feels like it's been lived in. So it becomes a song about experience and kind of resignation, and it's just very, very deep and rich, I think.
Well, let's have a listen. Let's enjoy the misogyny and narcissism and misery of Bob Dylan's "It Ain't Me, Babe," as done by Betty LeVette.
Gone all the way from my window. That your own chosen speak. I ain't the one you want, baby. I don't think I'm the one you need.
Betty Lovett with It Ain't Me, Babe, is chosen by Richard Benson. Next up, books. Specifically, Going for a Song, a chronicle of the UK record shop by Garth Cartwright. It charts a 50-year period where the record shop went from weirdo magnet to cultural gathering place to corporate behemoth and back to weirdo magnet again. What did we make of the book? Do we miss the record shops of our youth? We're going to talk about it all after this. This is more about listening to vinyl than buying vinyl, but anyway, it captures the romance. This is XTC with Spiral. XTC from the little tiny album Applebyte, Any Excuse to Play XTC. We're talking about Going for a Song, a chronicle of the UK record shop by Garth Cartwright, a far-ranging book which covers every aspect of the subject, maybe a bit too many aspects of the subject. The record shop paralleling social change in the country. I mean, for me, it had a bit of an atmosphere of a second-hand vinyl shop itself. Craig, what did you make of the book?
Yeah, I felt like I was digging in the crates where they're, you know, surrounded by cobwebs and spiders. You know, there's great pieces, bits of writing from Garth in this. You know, he starts off describing the kind of pre-indie years, if you like. You know, stinky, surly, and quite possibly psychotic. Such were the traits found in many a used record vendor. Then he goes on to describe them as variously Gollum and the characters from Waiting for Godot. And he was right. You know, these were the kind of troglodytes who inhabited these record stores, and by God, we loved them. So there's lots of great detail on the kind of weirdo male, usually almost always a male, who inhabited these places. Probably goes way too deep into the detail. There's lots of details on not just regional or local, but neighbourhood record shops in forgotten parts of various metropolises, which will have appealed to the five people who read this book who went to that shop.
Well, I don't know about that, because I found, I mean, it's, for me, the drawback of the book is there's two drawbacks. One is incredibly bitty and capsule-y, because we tend to discover the story of Andy's Records in detail, and then the story of Dub Vendor in detail. But I actually really liked those bits. It was like a collection of incredibly interesting 400-word features interspersed with the kind of, the other drawback, which is it seems to try to tell the story of the entire country. You know, like we used to see oh, you know, the rock and roll years, it's 1968, students in Paris are throwing bricks, but in a bedroom in London, you know, that kind of thing. There's a little bit of the rock and roll years about it. But yes, for all that, it had lots of really good anecdotes, I thought, and it gave me that, it did give me a bit of a nostalgic thrill. Richard, what did you think?
Well, I enjoyed long stretches of it. I found it really interesting when he wasn't trying to make a persuasive argument, and when he was just saying, here's this very detailed a very small little window through which you could see the whole of history if you wanted to. And and so when you... The chapter on Epstein and the Beatles, for example, I thought was really interesting. Because it just gave you a different angle on a story that has, you know, been told quite a few times at this point.
Yeah.
And I liked the way that it made you think about the commodification of the music, so that at the end of the day, you know, what we like talking about is the sound that we hear in our ears, but it's you know, there is a whole industry of people carrying bits of plastic in crates around, you know, and I quite liked the way that it made you aware of that side of it. And I also liked there's something underneath that he never makes this point, but there is this really nice thing about music, which is that not only does it give us an incredible amount of personal joy, but it also makes us want to share, doesn't it? So when you hear a record that you really love, after you've really loved the record, then what you want to do is make other people hear it. And I quite... There was a lot of that in there. So yeah. I like the guys who just started record shops to
And there's a bit more sort of personal investment in the shifting of physical objects and the physical sharing of physical objects, rather than what we do now is I'll send you a YouTube link, which you may or may not play. You may forget about it. You know, there was an investment of money and time and personal stuff in it. What I loved was the strange little details of the record resale business, like the shop These Records near the Imperial War Museum in South London, which was dedicated to selling music too strange for John Peel to play. They had a bathtub in the middle of the shop, piled high with reel to reel tapes. It was like Steptoe's yard. Now, Sean, you were not quite as persuaded by this book, were you?
Not really. I found that there were a lot of absolutes within it that were just taken as read about culture, about music and about consumption of music in that, oh, record shops are really good, especially the independent ones, but we don't really like music anymore. No, I think you'll find that Spotify is quite popular. People download. We're just consuming it in a different way. And he does say at some point the public became more and more interested in football and less interested in music. And there's no date to that. There's no anything to that. You just think, well, could you quantify that?
Also,
really?
It's not a zero-sum game, because my memory is that music was at its utter zenith of greatness and enjoyment at a time when football was as well. The early 90s. Yes. You know, St. Etienne, World in Motion.
I love little record shops. And I used to go, my local one was in Kingston, Beggar's Banquet, and he does talk about that one, Beggar's. And I used to go there, and every Saturday I'd go in and ask for a Saturday job. And of course, I said no. So that, to me, to evoke that was really great. But I felt it's the same story. So every record, it follows
the same arc.
Yeah.
But isn't that, I think that's actually true of bands as well. They all follow the same arc.
Yeah, but this is a book about all the bands in the world and they follow the same arc and that sort of thing.
That's true.
It's the lack of overview. I really like the fact that he's obviously dedicated most of his life to writing this book, but it lacks something to me of that real joy of going into a record shop and finding something. I can't get that from the book.
Yeah. You said you bought your stuff, you used to buy your records at Beggar's Banquet. Yeah. I used to go to Probe in Liverpool, which is in here, and the fearsome stories of Pete Burns are brilliant. Kicking a skinhead out of the shop, kicking him down the stairs. And if you know Probe, the stairs are quite high. Big burly skinhead had said the wrong thing to Pete. He boots him down the stairs and then runs down the stairs and stomps on his chest with a stiletto heel. And this burly skinhead runs away screaming. I was terrified of Pete Burns when he worked on the counter in there. I was so frightened of him because he was always in full gear. He was never in civvies. Those were his civvies. That's what he wore. And I wanted to buy a 12-inch by The Beat. And I was so terrified of him that all I could blurt out was the catalogue number. And he looked at me and he went, who gets records with a catalogue number? And I just stared in terror and he went, hang on a minute. Disappeared, came back and sort of chucked up and went, there you go. I was like, bloody hell, I've somehow passed the Pete Burns test here. There's a great story in here as well about someone who goes in to buy a 13th Floor Elevators album from Probe, you know, the absolute acme sine qua non of, you know, tasteful music. And gets it home, and Pete Burns has put 20 gold bars by Status Quo inside it instead. You know, just to teach him some sort of a lesson. I don't know.
I turned to that section of the book first. I wanted to read the Pete Burns stuff. That's, to me, what the book is about.
What we really need is a giant book about Pete Burns, don't we?
Yeah, I think we need that, don't we? Yeah.
Craig, where did you buy your records, and was it a hellish experience? Leading questions.
When I was at uni in Edinburgh, there was a shop called Avalanche Records, which was quite famous beyond Edinburgh. A guy, Kevin, ran it. And, you know, Kevin was a lovely guy, but, you know, where Pete Burns was clearly a raging personality, Kevin, you might say, had a bit of a personality black hole. And it was that kind of the sheer force of his gravity that made you fear that shop, because you get sucked into his blankness. But actually, he knew Scottish indie music inside out, whether it was Jesse Garn and the Desperados or Shop Assistants. So he was a real proselytiser for that real scratchy, very localised East Coast Scottish indie music. So in that regard, he was a proper local hero. Yeah. And he was right within the footprint of the university as well. So he was pretty student friendly, despite his kind of professional blankness, shall we say.
How about you, Richard? Where were you? What's your go-to?
Sydney Scarborough in Hull. And one of the things I thought about the book was just the difference between now when it's just a virtual thing. For me to buy a record, I would have had to earn the money somehow, and then I had to catch a bus to I grew up in a village. I catch a bus to the nearest town, get the train from the town to Hull, which seemed quite glamorous to me, walk through the Hull, and then go into Sydney Scarborough. And it was like levels of a video game, because then when you were in Sydney Scarborough, the record shop, but it was in the basement, where the good records were in the basement, right? The rock stuff was in the basement, which was really, really dark, and you had to go down. And I remember, you know, it was scary. As you descended the stairs, you're going, God, here I am, the kid from Wet Wank.
The kid from Wet Wank. That should have been the name of your autobiography, that kid from Wet Wank.
And the people behind the counter were absolutely the epitome of that surly thing where you whatever you asked for, they would kind of sneer about you. But I do remember you would be in there, and I remember being in and hearing the Chicona Youth record getting to Groovy, and just being so excited by it. And I thought, and I had to go and ask the kid what it was that was playing, and the sneer, and he's like, Chicona Youth.
Thousands of words have been written about the demise of the record shop and the sort of the return of the vinyl shop, which supposedly is filling the spot. And that, you know, there are places that are, you know, that are healthy and good, but also a lot of vinyl now is bought as a kind of an objet d'art to keep on your, you know, put on your shelf while you secretly play the 128k download that you you've got from.
I mean, and it's called vinyls, plural.
My God, what's the
point? Is it called vinyls?
That's what kids go. Have you got any vinyls?
Oh, no,
what?
Do they? I thought
I've got a lot of vinyls.
That's a Philomena the Cunk thing.
Yeah. I thought it was a joke, and then I heard, and somebody actually said it to me. I thought, my God, you actually.
Oh, I thought it was a joke.
Yeah, this is.
Do we sort of oversell? Do we oversell the romance of the vinyls?
Yes, I think so.
Quite happy. Got rid of loads.
I wanted a firebomb record shops after I'd finished this book. Quite frankly, the reverence towards it's like, oh, come on, I'm still listening to music. So are you? Well, it is a book about shops. It is a book about people buying stuff to make them look good. You know, latching on to.
But you've got to have something to make you look good. I mean, it's a fallacy.
Well, can't you look good?
Well, I don't know.
I think there's still a magic allure about vinyl that's maybe because of its, you know, tokenistic rarity these days. But when you hold the record, there's still something talismanic about it.
It's heavy,
and it just feels more proper. Even if the stuff inside it is a bit rubbish, there's just a kind of there's somehow an instant gravitas about it that you think, okay, this is somehow meaningful, even if it sounds
because of
like
the weight.
Because of the weight. It's weight. That's what I look for in music. Weight.
Well, you know, you can get heavier vinyl.
I love
they
that.
Sell it.
That's my favourite kind of vinyl.
Heavier. And it's more expensive.
Well, I was going for a song, a chronicle of the UK record shop by Garth Cartwright. Let's have some more contemporary music in the newfangled soulless, immaterial MP3 format. Craig McLean, what kind of not proper music that wasn't made on wooden instruments have you brought in to play to us?
So, Andrew, I have brought you a new track. It's not a single. We don't release singles anymore, apparently. The new track, the second track from Let's Eat Grandma's upcoming second album. Let's Eat Grandma are an 18 and a 19-year-old girl's best friends from Norwich called Rosa and Jenny. They released their first album, I Gemini, on Transgressive, hipper than now North East London indie label, 2 years ago when they were barely out of school. And it was a collection of weird, wonky witch pop, you might say, made on a collection.
Sean's ears are pricking up.
Hello.
You had me at weird wonky witch pop.
Yeah.
Made on a collection of battered clockwork powered keyboards and the likes. So their new track, Falling Into Me, is definitely a follow-up to Hot Pink, the first track from the second album. Again, with Falling Into Me, they've clearly soaked up some funk on their travels around the world, but they still have that idiosyncratic East Anglian girl approach to men, women, politics and emotions.
Excellent. Wonky Witch Pop. Let's have a listen. This is Let's Eat Grandma with Falling Into Me.
I pave the back street with the mist of my brain. I cross the gap between the platform and train. Falling into me.
Let's Eat Grandma with Falling Into Me, as chosen by Craig McLean. Now, it's 25 years since Suede released their eponymous debut album, riddled with 1990s preoccupations such as sex, small towns, drugs, sex. Suede was a firecracker of an album which rocketed up the charts and made Brett Anderson and co proper rock stars. It was lauded by people who didn't even like it. Now it's re-released in deluxe format with B-sides, live tracks and monitor mixes. Does it still sound as fresh as it did back then in 1992? What do we make of the extra bits? Let's hear a track from those extras. This is the great lost B-side, My Insatiable One.
As the ridiculous wild man.
With My Insatiable One. Brett Anderson and Bernard Butler at first fated as the new Morrissey and Marr, but then they went on to create something that was wholly their own. What were your thoughts, Craig? Were you a floppy-haired, androgynous Swedey boy?
You're a Swede head now.
I was indeed. I had the kind of post-grunge haircut at the time. I got rid of my ponytail around about that time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, My Insatiable One, I don't remember that as a B-side. I remember that as a double A-side. Mm. You know, back in the day when you would flip the 12-inch and listen to the songs religiously, which I did with that. Those first, the four singles off that first album, still sound fantastic, evocative, emotive, you know, slightly shrill and alarming. Absolutely fantastic. I bow to Andrew's far superior Suede knowledge and appreciation, but for me, you know, this discs 5, 7, 8, 9, and 10, I began to lose a wee bit of interest. The live album is just a cacophony of scratchy chaos, you know, which is great for some live albums, but not for one I want to listen to.
It very much sounds like a bootleg cassette, doesn't it?
It does.
And you know, I suppose if you're the kind of person who wants a 4-album version of Suede, you'll be happy with that. You don't necessarily want a 5.1 monitor surround mix mate for, you know, done on doubly. You just, you know, you want the noise and the chaos and that. And I like the fact that you can hear people screaming and, you know, really get into this very strange moment in pop. But you're right, it's not hi-fi, is it?
No, it's not. You'll know, Andrew, which of these demos that are on here, I think the point of interest for the demos are the ones that Justine Frischmann's on. Are those the Rockenhorst demos?
Possibly, yeah. To be honest, I didn't get into enough detail on that one, but a few of these have been out before because Suede do have a bit of a Morrissey habit of doing a lot of re-releases, which I'm happy with. You don't have to buy them. For me, the interesting bits that you hadn't heard before were the radio sessions, like Mark Goodyear and things like that, where some of the arrangements are actually quite different and quite interesting. My problem with the demos is that Suede had clearly nailed it so immensely, they knew exactly what they were doing. So the demos aren't really wildly different from the recorded version, but the session versions are. I found that quite interesting.
The track across different versions that I found interesting was Metal Mickey, because I remember when that came out, Brett Anderson complained, didn't he? And he said that it wasn't crunchy and metal-y enough on the album. So I thought it was quite interesting to hit. Well, you think, well, I've... Yo, he's always moaning about something. That's my memory of Brett Anderson.
Bloody Hayward's Heath.
Yeah.
But I remember that being an issue. And I remember it because Metal Mickey is my favourite track of film. So it's quite interesting hearing the Mark Goodyear version, and then there's the live version. And I think it does get, in the Mark Goodyear version, it is more noisy and metally, and certainly in the live version it's quite, you know, it feels quite metal.
Do the songs have the same impact that they did in 92? Because I hadn't listened to Suede for years, I mean decades, until I came back to this and just thought, oh my god, yeah, oh, they've got it, you know. They still sound amazing, those songs. Is that the same for you? Did it kind of spark that?
It was for me. I liked it in a way almost better now, because I found him a bit annoying at the time. Mm. And
for what reasons did you find the floppy-haired, androgynous, tambourine-waving?
Talking the face, he there was a bit of a legal thing with him and Amy Raphael, who I worked with at the face at the time, because he claimed that she had made up a quote about him meeting Morrissey, and she hadn't made up a quote. It was on tape, and barmily, in those days, this what could happen with pop music. So then the Daily Telegraph ran the story, because Tony Parsons told the Telegraph. This became quite a thing. And then apparently Murray Chalmers, PR, and Morrissey then got involved in this argument about whether Brett had met Morrissey. So, and that clouds my memory of it. So when I heard the record out with all that, it really showed me what an amazing record it is. Mm. Absolutely amazing.
I think so, yeah. Because unlike Blur and Oasis, they haven't been massively overplayed in the intervening quarter century. So there's a freshness to these songs, because they were obliterated by the bands who came after in the so-called Britpop wave that they initially catalysed. So I think that made me prick up my ears.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly sort of, they went off into their own kind of outsider thing, and Dogman Star absolutely bamboozled everyone. What are you doing? You've made a Pink Floyd. You've made a kind of homoerotic Pink Floyd album. Okay. And then the next one was like, you've done Tin Machine, but you've done it right. And that's interesting, you know. Mm-hmm. But they were sort of, they violently moved very out of sync very, very quickly. I think this still stands up as an absolutely one of the great debut albums of all time. And just Sleeping Pills is just such a transfixing one.
Wonderful.
One little thing on this box set of four, whatever it is, there's one track on there which we had as a select tape when we used to give away tapes on the cover of Select, and it's the piano version of My Insatiable One, which we got in, you know, when we were trying to assemble these, when you gave away free cassettes, and we were just absolutely nailed to the wall by this astonishing performance. When you realize that, as well as being able to do these ridiculous kind of glam rock perv out JG ballad, you know, freak epics. They also had this kind of Jacques Brel thing on the go as well. And I'm really glad that that's on it, because that's a little bit of I was there. That was my thing. Did Suede end up on? Suede did the cover of The Face before they did Select, didn't they? I think you got them first.
Yeah, we did. Well, I don't remember the first one. I remember the later one with the all time quote unquote great cover line. What have Suede been up to? And you opened on the inside, the answer was, oh, not very much of interest, it seems. They've made a very poor album and they're making a really boring interview here. So that was late on, though. That was like album four, I think.
That might have been the one I wrote, actually, where I think I wrote that cover story and managed over 4,000 words not to notice that Brett Anderson was on heroin. Well done, Andrew. Investigative reporting chops there. Yes.
To be clear, I was criticising the cover line, not the feature, Andrew.
But Andrew, can I... I remember the famous Britpop Suede cover of Select, and then he subsequently has complained about not liking Britpop, hasn't he? Not liking the term Britpop. Did they kind of come back on that at the time? Did they complain about it?
They weren't best pleased. Subsequently, because we're great showbiz friends now, and we often go out drinking and... no, we don't really. We've sort of... I think it's kind of been seen as sort of water under the bridge. That whole thing was cooked up with Andrew Collins and Stuart McConey. And I think the cover, the actual idea of putting... I'm not sort of trying to say it wasn't my fault, because it was a brilliant idea and I wish I'd thought of it. But the Union Jack cover idea, I think, was Andrew Collins' idea. And yes, we did it without their permission, because we were just out of control. We couldn't be told. And it didn't go down particularly well. But the irony is that Britpop issue featured neither Blur, because we'd already done them, nor Oasis, because we hadn't really figured yet. So our idea of the steaming kind of, vanguard of Britpop was Suede, yes, that's great, and Denim.
Yeah, I remember Denim.
And Pulp.
That issue.
Yeah, and Saint Etienne. And, but I looking back, I mean, much as I love Blur, and much as I love very early Oasis, I think we actually got it right. That was the better end of Britpop. That was the more interesting end of Britpop. This is a big old thing to make your way through this box, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't listen to the live stuff because I'd seen Suede live and I don't want to re-remember it. I want to remember them because they were amazing. There's a point where they were just the best live band in Britain. I know that's a really crappy thing to say, but they were fantastic. Brett, either on an amazing amount of adrenaline or masses of drugs, was just this whirling dervish, and the songs kind of came, the 3D song became 4D. They were so exciting. So I refuse to listen to the live stuff now completely.
Okay. Well, I think it's a one-listen thing.
Also, the lyrics are fantastic, and I've forgotten how bloody amazing the lyrics are. He is so poetic and literary and romantic, and it's like, wow.
Which is what makes his book, by all accounts, so good, because I've not read it.
Apparently it is very good, yeah. So that's a 25-year edition of Suede by Suede, available in non-physical record shops right now.
Finally, we've been a bit merciless with our guests over the past few weeks, insisting that they expose the album that only they like to the derision of everybody else. But this week we're going to do something a bit different, but something slightly the same. What's the objectively awful song that you can't help but love, and why? Almost everyone with ears likes a song which is not so much bad, but plain terrible. What makes us humans steer towards things that are pat, overwrought, tuneless, and anodyne? What is it? Let's hear them before we talk about them. Close your ears.
You talk like Marlene Dietrich, and you dance like Zizi Jarmer. Your clothes are all made by Balmain, and there's diamonds and pearls in your hair. Yes, there are.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Not surprised, not everything lasts. I've broken my heart so many times I stopped keeping track. Talk myself in, I talk myself out. I get all worked up, then I let myself down. I tried so very hard not to lose it. I
came up with a million excuses.
So that was If You Didn't Spot Them. Down, Down by Status Quo, Don't Stop Believing by Journey, Michael Bublé with Haven't Met You Yet, and Where Do You Go To, My Lovely by Peter Starsted. Not necessarily in that order, because wonderful producer Sophie is going to make them sound a bit better than I just listed them down. Let's get to the most contentious one. Who chose Down, Down by The Quo? Put your hand up. Benson.
That was me.
Benson, how dare you? Explain yourself.
I would have I have three defences of this record. Number one, I think that the mid-70s Status Quo were not quite as bad as the terrible later 70s and 80s Status Quo. So that when they used to produce themselves in the mid-70s, there was a kind of a sort of a rough charm about them. And some of the singles have just got this relentless, driving, slightly speedy feel to them. It feels like being really drunk and driving a car really fast, and you know, two things that would be great if you could do it.
So you were allowed to do them, and they went against the law. Yes,
and I like that feel about it. But I do realise that it is not a, you know, not an accomplished record. It's a three chord thrash, really. But the other thing about it is that when I hear this record, I have this picture in my head. So when I was growing up, the first think like nights out that I would go to would be these village discos, right, in East Yorkshire where I lived. And
we are back to Wet Wang.
Yeah, okay. So I've got a theme going
we
on.
We always go back
so,
to Wet Wang.
Yeah, everything does.
Yeah.
So at these discos, this would be some early 80s, you would get these gangs of bikers turn up. Bikers, greebos, like sleeveless denim jackets.
Trogs.
You may call them trogs. Mm. And they used to... They would, you know, have these incredible sort of decorated sleeveless jackets and like brilliant bikes outside, and they would, when Quo came on, they used to line up down the middle of the hall and do this dance. Do you know the Quo
the
dance?
Pile yeah. driver.
Oh, is that what it's called?
It's called the pile driver.
Is that the thing with, yeah. with your thumbs and your belt loops?
Yes, that. Yeah. And I remember thinking this looked kind of amazing. Like, it's not something I particularly wanted to do, but it looked pretty good. You know, with the hair, it certainly smelled pretty interesting.
Oh God!
But it would and. There's a kind of spectacle to that. And when I hear that Down Down track coming on, it makes me think of that spectacle in North Frillingham Village Hall. And I quite like thinking about it.
Christian thought.
Yeah.
I've got to say, I mean, this is so much not my thing at all. But I have to take issue with the idea that it's like not a well-made record, because I think this is basically an acid house record played on guitars. Endless repetition. Yeah, it sounds like hard floor or something played on guitars. So I'm going to say that, I can see why there is a guilt element to liking it, but I actually think it might be a bit of a better record than you're letting on.
Yes, I did wonder that on the way here, actually, when I was thinking about it. I feel like I'm defending Quo as a terrible thing, rather than the actual record itself maybe isn't that bad. Sorry about that. It's also Status Quo's only ever number one, by the
oh,
way.
Oh, really?
It is, yeah, January 1975.
Fantastic. Well, there we go. Status Quo have invented acid house. Craig McLean, what have you got?
So, growing up in the rock-loving provinces in the early 80s, even in that milieu, there was a certain wing of the genre that, you know, dare not, the love of which dare not speak its name, and that was soft rock, probably because it was called soft rock. So you didn't like Asia, you couldn't like Boston, you couldn't like REO Speedwagon, and you certainly couldn't like Journey. But I did. I liked all of them. And I bought Journey's Don't Stop Believing on 7-inch with a free patch stuck to the middle of the 7-inch, which Julie... I agonised over whether to keep it on the single to keep its integrity intact or stick it on my denim jacket or get my mum to put it on the denim jacket, to be clear. I think in the end I kept it on the single. And Don't Stop Believing was just, in my kind of early teens, was just a euphoric, anthemic cri de la cour for me, which I could share with precisely no one. And, you know, I kept that hidden away for years and years and years. And then imagine my surprise when I sat down to watch the opening episode of Ryan Murphy's almighty Glee, 25 years later. And the very first song in the very first episode of Glee, sung by the a cappella group at this lovely American high school, was an a cappella version of Don't Stop Believing. Well, I just about fell off my denim jacket. On the one hand, I was pleased that it was had been clearly embraced by a new generation. On the other hand, I thought, hang on a minute, this has been my guilty secret for a quarter of a century. And it then became kind of cool in a way, because Glee was cool for a minute. And it being, there was Gleeks and a whole phenomenon around that show for about the first season and a half. And so Glee became, that song, Don't Stop Believing, was kind of co-opted by a new generation of smiley, happy young American youth, which kind of narked me a bit. But actually, I came back around again when I realised that it was so overplayed as a result of Glee that people hated it all over again. So, you know, I was allowed to enjoy it as my own thing, and I stood by it.
Not at all contrary, then.
Yeah. I hated it before it was cool to hate it for people liking it before it was cool to hate it.
That's me all over.
Yeah, absolutely. I've hated it consistently throughout. The happiness and the positivity nauseates me. My choice, speaking of happiness and nauseating positivity, Where Do You Go to My Lovely by Peter Starstead. This is an objectively dreadful record.
It's awful.
It's really, really bad, and yet I like it. I don't know why. I can't help myself. Not only is it kind of cloying and twee, but it has an immensely nasty undercurrent. It's basically a stalker going on about this woman who no longer who's left him, so he hates her for all her achievements and thinks that she's shallow, but he's kind of creeping around and looking and, you know, following her life.
He can't let go.
It's like that film Insane we saw last week, except with accordions and Frenchness. Yeah, it's like it's got a really sort of nasty element to it, and yet the accordions, the kind of Biarritzy feel of it, the kind of pre-rock parallel bloody, light entertainment aspect of it, just gets me every time. And I found myself singing it at karaoke the other day. It is an awful record that I like. And one thing that makes me like it even more is that friend of the show and Guardian rock correspondent Alexis Petridis hates this song with such a passion. And every sort of 2 or 3 months, it will pop up on Facebook, Alexis posting it going, how can anybody bear this Christ-awful record?
And there you are.
And then we all have the same conversation about what makes a good record and a bad record. And there has been a good version of this made. Neil Hannon, which we just mentioned, basically took all the ideas and the feel of this and rewrote it as a woman of a certain age from one of his albums. And it's got that sort of Mediterranean, Biarritzy kind of, yachty feel to it, but it's a very empathic song about a sad aging woman whose glittering life no longer means anything.
Oh dear.
So the superstructure is there to make it into a good song, but this is a terrible song that I like. Sean, what's yours?
Mine obviously is Haven't Met You Yet by Michael Bublé, which is a great song. It's perfectly structured, it's beautifully sung. I don't care if Michael Bublé's the most bland pop star in the world. When I hear that, I just feel happy. Now, there's this great line in it, and it's the phrasing. He's Sinatra, it's the phrasing, where he sings, I guess it's half-timing, the other half's luck. And he pronounces the other half's luck with sluck, and it sounds so rude. And it always gets me, and I just think, wow, he's a dirty man underneath him. Maybe I like him for... I'm so really, really happy when I put this song on. I can't explain why any more than that, because it's obviously completely illogical.
He's no Lawrence from Denham, though, is he, in terms of the kind of channeling of the male ego?
No, I think they're really quite far apart, Bublé and Lawrence.
And in the same continuum somehow.
Yeah. But really, I would say all listeners, go and listen to those songs. Be happy for a while. Stop worrying about things.
The moral of the story is we are too old to be discriminating on music in terms of what people will think of us because we... I don't know if I'm going to be listening to any of your choices myself. But then doubtless you won't be listening to Where Do I Go to My Peter Sarsden, so whatever. Anyway, time is running out and we're almost at the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a Jeroboam of Chateau Mouton Rothschild at their local Booze Busters? Craig McLean, I believe you've been hanging around with famous people.
Yeah, this week I've been quote-unquote on the road with... Oscar-winning actor turned rock star Jared Leto and his mega-selling sugar pop band 30 Seconds to Mars. Fascinating character, Jared Leto. You know, you might not think his music amounts to much. He has sold 15 million albums, but of course popularity is no guarantee of quality. He is having the time of his life fronting his rock band. He's 45 years old. He lives in an Air Force base in Laurel Canyon or thereabouts. Doesn't need to act ever again, and maybe he shouldn't after this Joker in Suicide Squad. But he's having a ball. Him and his brother Shannon rescued each other from the brink of, in his brother's case particularly, alcohol, drugs and crime, and to purify themselves in their rock band. And they're on a 70-day world arena tour with an album called America. See what they did there?
Yeah.
Very timely. And he's just loving it. And his actual unabashed glee at the 10,000 Glaswegians at the weekend, the euphoria thereof was something to behold. This is a guy who's living the dream.
It's a fine turn-up for the books, isn't it, when to get away from alcohol, drugs and crime, you have to join a rock band. I thought the point of joining rock bands was for the alcohol, the drugs and the crime.
It's a new time of rock band, I'm afraid.
God almighty, well, 12-step rock and roll.
Yeah, but he has been purified by it. You know, he wears the latest Gucci collection clothes, because he's an ambassador for Gucci, and it's a dry tour, and he shamelessly wears a top knot. So, and he gets away with all of this for the sheer force of his enjoyment and personality. And I thought, fair play to you, mate. Actually, you're giving it a good punt here. He's also a very successful tech investor. He invested in Spotify, Airbnb, Uber, I think, and he's got it all going on. He is single though.
I'm sure when the listeners have heard this, Craig, won't be for long. Yes, the Hot Topic Marlon Brando is available, and we can withdraw our ambassador to Gucci. Richard, I believe you've got something about crowdfunding.
Oh, well, at the other end of the spectrum, the slightly nerdier end of the spectrum. So I just noticed this thing that, this week when I was looking at the Unbound website. Unbound is a kind of a new kind of publishing house where it enables you to crowdfund books. And if you put your idea for your book on their site, and if people express an interest and commit to buying it at a certain level, then they will they'll publish it. And I was looking to see that. I was kind of interested in the sort of thing that gets interest and that gets funding, because I often think publishers don't have a very good sense of what people are interested in. And the Unbound site would suggest that they certainly have been missing out on a market, because one of the things that really struck me was how many books there were, suggestions for books about obscure video games. So not just video games, but just to give you an idea of the titles: Hardcore Gaming, Japanese Video Game Obscurities, Terrible Old Games You Have Probably Never Heard Of.
That's a good
title. Sounds like an item on the show, actually.
Fascinating and Downright Bizarre Facts About Old Video Games. And The Secret History of Mac Gaming. Those are just four of many. Oh. All of those titles have got more than 100% or more than 100% of their funding. Mm. So this makes me think, what a huge untapped scene there is for for books about very obscure video games and this army of people out there who have been underserved until now.
So my investigative oral history of that snake thing, where the snake just pings around and you knock it, I could get that funded.
Get it on there.
Or asteroids. Hemorrhoids, as my granddad used to call it.
Get that on there. Again. You will soon be living a Jared Leto kind of life if you get that on
there. There we go. Listen up, listeners. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Crowdfunding too. there is a DJ couple who I think many people may have made fun of on social media for their Kickstarter campaign, where they were trying to raise £76,000 to DJ around the world and to buy some equipment and to just be cool. They've raised £47 so far, but actually, and I think it will have ended by the time the show goes out, I just really admire their pluck. Why not? Why not put yourself out there and ask for £76,000? Why not say, we're DJs and all we want to do is go to some hotels and DJ? And everyone think that's stupid. I think they're amazing. I obviously haven't given them any money at all, but I really admire people who put themselves out. There are too many people who are criticising all the time. Good on you.
So you're
sorry that you've got 47 quid, but maybe they could do something
like
that.
You're admiring their sheer brass neck.
Absolutely.
And if you'd like to support Big Mouth on Patreon, we are...
Can you admire our brass?
Well, mine is... my closing time chapter is a fantastic piece I read on Bloomberg, of all things. I read Bloomberg because I'm a massive Tory, about how political targeting on social media, the whole Cambridge Analytica thing, was honed by diet pill people and the creators of junk ads. You know that crap you see at the bottom of the internet? And it always says... Oh, it's a picture of a woman peeling the skin off her face and looking young. Or an advert that says, police in Warrington advise you carry this at all times. It's like a stick with a light on the end
apple
of it.
Apple cider vinegar.
Garbage. Yes, wasps cure cancer, all this stuff. It is a multi-billion dollar industry. And this incredible piece on Bloomberg, which I will post on, ironically enough, the Facebook page, which shows how these techniques have actually been taken by the Russian disinformation operatives. And this is where it was all hammered out. This Polish guy's become a multi-millionaire many times over as a result of just crap ads for, drink raw water or here's how to stay young. But the technology was taken on by everybody that is now destroying our politics. And sometime guest on the show, Joe Muggs, made quite a good point on, again, social media irony, saying that effectively, if physics, nuclear physics had a moral reckoning with Oppenheimer and the invention of nuclear weaponry. They had to look at what they've done. And what's happening now with Cambridge Analytica and Aggregate IQ and fake news and Trump and bots and all the rest of it is going to have to be the moral reckoning of computer science for now. This is what we've done. This is what we've enabled. And if you like that story, please share and tweet. Please share, tweet, like. Caring is sharing.
And there's an online form that you can fill in with a poll. Give you a pound, yeah.
Yeah, share it and we'll have all your data. And on that jolly note, we've come to the end of the show. Thanks to our special guests, Bitty McLean and George Benson. Uh-huh. You've got to go and write up your Jared Leto bit now. Yes.
I do. I feel empowered to do so. But I might crowdfund some adjectives, though, if anyone can help
there
me with
you
that.
Go. Yeah. Absolutely. How about you, Richard? What's next on your plate?
Oh, I'm going to go and write my pitch for my History of Galaxians.
I'd read that. Thank you again, as usual, to my wing person, Sean Pattenden, and thanks to producer Sophie Black. Remember, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. No data collected. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us a pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. Some data collected, but only the stuff that you're willing to share with us. And we'd love you for that. So thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to Sophie. Thanks to Sean. Goodbye, everyone. We'll